So really, what I wanted to do was share some ideas I had about reconstructing quantum theory that occurred to me while I was teaching a seminar at UW last term. It was a philosophy seminar on philosophy of quantum theory, but it was the sort of seminar that there was a core group of, well, it was undergraduates and graduates. There were physics students, philosophy students, math students, at both the undergrad and grad level. So it was really a productive place in which to discuss some of the methodological motivations and issues that arise when engaging in reconstructions of quantum theory. So it was a quite unusual way to teach a philosophy of quantum theory seminar. So usually the way those types of seminars go is you run through a series of different interpretations of quantum theory and debate and discuss the merits and disadvantages of different approaches. But instead, I elected to look into reconstructing quantum theory, and it was really interesting. And so I hope the ideas I'm going to present are not really well polished, and I'm really interested to hear what people think about the approach that I'm going to suggest. By the way, is this title taken? Seems like too good of a title to not have been taken. Okay.
Well, reconstructing quantum theory.
Yeah, the art of the possible bit.
It's usually politics that's the art of the possible.
Well, that's, you know, that's, so there's some pragmatic dimension to what's going on. Anyway, so, all right. Okay, so context. When I talk about reconstructions of quantum theory, I know that there's a large literature on the subject and it's growing. What I really have in mind is the strand of reconstruction that starts with Lucien's 2001 five reasonable axioms, and then has developed in a bunch of different directions since then. So I don't specifically have in mind device independent approaches, mostly because I don't know much about them. What I'm saying could apply to them, but I'm not claiming that it does. And so I've also found really useful the Kerbel and Speckens collection brings together a bunch of really useful material and has a really nice introduction in which they say that the goal is to find a compelling set of axioms that singles out quantum theory from among all possible theories. So this is where I'm getting the idea of having a modal methodology, which I take it proceeds like this. So the first step of reconstructing quantum theory is to set out some sort of general mathematical framework in which the reconstruction is going to proceed. So in some sense, the general mathematical framework is going to frame a landscape of possible theories. So what I have in mind here as an example is the GPT framework, which is an operational framework in which there are distinguished preparation, transformation, and measurements. And the framework is a framework of probabilistic theories in that space. Once you've figured out what framework, yes?
Can you define, or will you define modal methodology? Or we'll just see what it means.
So modal means trading on what's possible. I will talk about it in contrast to another methodology on the next slide. So what I take as modal about this methodology is that the goal is to pick out quantum theory from within this space of possible theories. Or if you don't want to think of the general mathematical framework as giving you a space of possible, physically possible theories, at least you have a space of mathematical possibilities from which you want to pick out quantum theory. Okay, so the way of doing that is once you've got your mathematical framework, then you formulate some physical principles. And then the third step is to use those physical principles as a basis for positing mathematical axioms. And then there's a lot of work that's involved in proving that your mathematical axioms are going to uniquely pick out quantum theory from the landscape of possible theories, from among that mathematical space of possibilities. Okay, so why is this? Yeah, go ahead.
I always make this comment at this point.
So. Okay.
I mean, the way you framed it, I think it's a little too special to include gravity, quantum gravity.
Right.
And that's, to some of us, that's the main motivation for trying to understand quantum mechanics better.
Okay, good. So from what I've said so far, gravity is not is not necessarily going to be in that space, right? Is that the worry that you have?
Yeah,
the if you're starting the GPT, the GPT framework.
Yes, which has measurement in it. It has a sort of time slicing built in because you have, or at least it has some sort of S matrix type sense to it, preparation, transformation, measurement.
Okay. Good. So one of the themes that's going to be, well, one of the things I'm going to talk about here is the role that unification plays. So I think unification is a major motivation for pursuing this type of methodology. So I'll talk about quantum gravity a little bit later in that context. Okay, so why am I interested in this as a philosopher? Well, so first of all, one reason why I'm interested is, as I said, the standard way of thinking about philosophy of quantum theory is to canvas a bunch of alternative traditional interpretations of quantum theory and try and figure out which one is your favorite interpretation. So that way of thinking about quantum theory is a scientific realist way of thinking about quantum theory, where you think of the goal of science is to give you theories which then produce some sort of approximately accurate or approximately true picture of the way the world is. And the trouble in quantum theory from that way of thinking about it is to try and figure out what exactly this theory is telling you about the way the world is. What's intriguing about this picture is it's not anti-realist. So anti-realist is rejecting that as a goal of science. It's not anti-realist, but it's certainly taking a roundabout approach to answering the question about what quantum theory is telling us about the way the world is like. So I find that interesting as a philosopher, that this methodology is distinguished by that feature. Well, I'll say a little bit more about that later. I'm also interested in the history of physics. So one of the motivations that's often cited for pursuing a reconstruction program in quantum theory is that this is a way of formulating quantum theory as a principle theory, where a principle theory is opposed to a constructive approach to theorizing. And this, of course, is the distinction that Einstein introduced. So this approach is very much rooted in the history of physics, and so I'm interested in following up in this talk in a little bit more detail what those historical motivations are for pursuing this approach. I'm also interested in this methodology because there's some similarities here with some of the work that I've done thinking about axiomatic approaches to quantum field theory, which I'll talk about at the end of the talk. So there's a similar kind of methodology, different goals for the methodology, but there's a similar kind of methodology that you find in that case. A bunch of people are sitting here, hopefully people who are engaged in the reconstruction project and wondering, I've talked about this modal methodology, wondering about what the alternative might be. Well, I've given a hint already that the alternative, I think, has to do with having an explicitly scientific realist attitude at the outset towards the purpose of scientific theorizing. So here's what I see as being the alternative to adopting this modal methodology where you care about the space of mathematically possible theories or physically possible theories. So this alternative is roughly that we're warranted in believing that our current best scientific theories give approximately true descriptions of the actual world in restricted domains. Okay, so this is the claim that scientific realists make. So what we should be focusing on, if that's front and center in your attitude towards science, is we should be focusing on taking advantage when we're constructing our next theory of that information which we have about the way the world is. So if you're focusing on what the theory tells us about the actual world, then what you're looking at is a series of a whole set of concrete models of different types of systems, and you're focused on those models and learning what you can about the world. So what you're not interested in is theorizing about possible worlds in which our theories are exactly true, right? Because if you're looking for a next theory, then you know our theories that we have right now aren't exactly true. You're also not interested in necessarily imagining possible worlds in which alternative theories are true. Because again, you're focused on actual theories and what our theories are telling us about the actual world. Okay, so I think that this is what I'm trying to flesh out here is a sort of intuition about how to do physics. I don't know, and I think this comes out in sometimes it's kind of implicit in some approaches to physics. It's hard to make it explicit. What I'm trying to draw out here is, if you want to defend the modal methodology, the methodology that you use when you're pursuing reconstructions of quantum theory, one thing you might think is that if you pursue the reconstruction program, then you can answer a question that you can't answer if you're sticking to interpreting our best theories as telling us approximate truths about the actual world. And that question is, why the quantum, right? So why the quantum is a question which prompts certain, is a demand for a certain type of explanation about why quantum theory rather than any other type, any other of the theories in the landscape of possible theories. So if you're engaged in the reconstruction project, this can be, you might think of this as an advantage of your approach over narrowly focusing on what our theories say about the actual world. But I think the counter would be that you don't really feel like this is the sort of question that needs to be answered. Okay, so this is what I mean when I say I'm trying to capture a kind of intuition here about a way of approaching physics to which I think that the reconstruction program is opposed. Yes?
That sentence, theorizing about possible worlds.
Yes.
I can't see it looks self-contradictory, or it looks like it leaves you nothing, no alternative. Theorizing about possible worlds in which our theories are exactly true misconstrues the nature of our scientific knowledge. Is that right? But also imagining possible worlds in which alternative theories are true misconstrues the nature. So what's left? I mean, you can't imagine worlds in which some other theory is true. You can't imagine that our present theory is true. So that's like saying no theory, it's exactly true.
It's exactly true.
Our present theory is not exactly true, but also alternative theories are not true either.
So imagining possible worlds, right? So in our world, there's some theory which we do not possess. For our world, there's some theory which we do not possess. Hopefully in the future we'll possess it, which is the true theory for our world, right? Which is going to include quantum gravity and maybe other stuff we don't even know about, right? So the question here is, let's turn this into a practical question. We want to get to quantum gravity. How are we going to get to quantum gravity? One methodology would be to, at least as a first step, think about quantum theory and employ this methodology. Then maybe you have to do it again to think about quantum gravity, right? And you have to alter this framework, right? That's also in the cards. But this way of proceeding is a methodology in which you think about all the possibilities, even ones you know which are not true in our world, right? And then try and use that way of thinking to come up with principles, which then tell you about what's special about your world compared to other possible worlds. What I'm trying to contrast that idea with is the idea that no, the starting point for coming up with quantum gravity and other and the right theory should be just to focus on the theories we have right now and what they tell us about the actual world. Okay, so forget about imagining other possible worlds and what they could be like. Just stick to the limited information we have about how this theory describes the actual world in domains in which it's valid, right? So if you're talking about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, obviously we don't expect it to be valid in domains, in relativistic domains. So restrict, we know our knowledge is limited. Right.
What's an example of somebody who does this kind of thing? Oh,
I was trying not to name names. So I think that this is the kind of approach that traditional interpreters of quantum mechanics have in mind. Okay, so when you're interpreting quantum theory, and if you say that the Everett interpretation is the right interpretation, what's the goal of interpreting quantum theory? Well, the goal is, we know non-relativistic quantum mechanics is not the ultimate theory, but what we can extract from it is an approximate picture of the way the world is in the domains in which it applies. Okay, so then you start talking about branching as being some type of emergent phenomena, right? If you're following contemporary approaches to the Everett interpretation. So that would be the kind of thing that I have in mind here.
Isn't there string theories? The string theory is following this approach. The second approach.
The second approach of...
More or less all of string theory, or the people who working in that tradition are following, I think, your second approach.
The second approach of focusing on the theories we have and interpreting them as being, is giving us accurate, approximately accurate pictures of the way the world is in limited domains.
In fact, they're going farther. They're raising the level, some of the things that we know from quantum field theory to the level of principles from flat space quantum field theory that must even be true in all theories. You know, the list of
right.
Things that were used historically to justify string theory, unitarity, freedom from anomaly, various things like this were used, were taken essentially as principles.
Right, as ingredients, as input for...
Well, principles that any theory must satisfy.
Right.
Yeah, ingredients. Right?
Yeah.
But they're certainly not, what they're not doing is calling into question anything about standard quantum mechanics. If it's your second,
right?
I think
yes. Okay. Yeah. Insofar as you're not questioning some sort of core that you take is giving you an approximately accurate picture.
Maybe canonical quantum gravity.
Right. Canonical quantum gravity.
You take general relativity, treat it as a Hamiltonian system, quantize it following the standard rules, as far as you can make that work.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
On the first slide, I suppose the worry with this approach is that this landscape of possible theories, there's a lot hanging on that, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
If you hope to make progress. I mean, if you were trying to make the leap from Newtonian gravity to general relativity, then it's hard to imagine how you could do that in
right. Okay, good. So this is the sort
of what concepts are you know, this landscape of possible theories will share some concepts, presumably. Do those concepts already exist, or are you allowing new concepts to come into your possible theories, your landscape, are concepts that aren't part of our current theories?
Okay,
right.
Good.
And to leap from Newtonian gravity to general relativity, yeah.
You need new ingredients.
Yeah.
Okay.
New concept, new physical concept.
Right. Okay, so what I'm going to do is talk about the MODO methodology and look for a justification for it in a case in which I think it worked in the past. So it's not going to be the case of Newtonian gravity to general relativity. It's going to be the case of the development of electromagnetism.
So there's another methodology which isn't this one and isn't the modal one, but is that you would say encapsulates.
General relativity, first of all, took a while to get to the right framework, which was sort of calculus and manifolds. But even once he got there, there was a lot of open as to what the right equations were. And eventually he found, you know, the field equation and the technique for converting special relativistic equations into general relativistic equations, which sort of constitutes general relativity. But people have done other things within that framework and alternatives to GR. So I think you could think of GR in a similar context. In that case, the framework is differential geometry, the metric, so on. I think that sort of modal way of thinking works in that case too. Maybe that's not what we have in mind.
So let's come back to this question at the end. Okay. So I appreciate that one of the big motivations for pursuing this program is to see it as a step to getting towards quantum gravity, right? So the natural thing to think about is to think about GR. I'm in a way taking a step back, right, and looking at another, I think, more straightforward historical example where it's clear that the methodology worked. And I think one of the things that recommends pursuing the modal methodology is if we look at the history of physics, we can see cases in which it has worked, right? So that makes it not guaranteed to succeed in the future. Obviously, we don't have anything that good in science, but it at least recommends it as an approach that's worth trying out, right? Okay, so in particular, what the modal methodology was successful in the past in doing for us was in helping us to develop new theories, which is the sort of thing we want to do. One of the big questions in the background is this question about unification, and I'll get to that in a couple minutes. Okay, so the modal approach, what I'm calling the modal methodology, is associated with the principal approach to theorizing that Einstein distinguishes from the constructive theory approach to doing physics. So this is the way he talks about this distinction in a number of different places in his writings. This is the version that he sets out in 1919 when he's talking about the special theory of relativity and the contribution he thinks that he's made there. So what he has in mind as a paradigm example is the contrast between thermodynamics as a principal theory and the kinetic theory of gases in particular, the model that you get of gases in statistical mechanics as an example of a constructive theory. And he argues that the approach that he takes to special relativity is another example of a principal theory. Okay, so briefly, the main essence of the distinction is that constructive theories follow what he calls the synthetic method. So the idea is that you're attempting to build up a picture of the more complex phenomena out of the materials of a relatively simple formal scheme from which they start out. So what he has in mind by a formal scheme is you assume that you have you have a model of gases where you have a bunch of particles, and then you can apply assumptions from Newtonian mechanics to these individual particles, and then you build out a picture of that. So the assumptions that you're making are about the constituents of this model. This is contrasted with what he calls the principal approach to theories, which follows the analytic method, where your starting point is setting out a bunch of principles, and then you deduce consequences of the principles that you set out. So you don't start out when you're setting out your principles with a bunch of hypotheses about the constituents of your system. Instead, you're supposed to step back a little bit and think about facts that you've empirically discovered. The sorts of facts that you care about are facts that describe general characteristics of natural processes. And this is in bold, because I think this fits nicely with the reconstruction program. And the point of doing this is that these principles give rise to mathematically formulated criteria, which separate processes or theoretical representations of them have to satisfy. So the idea here is you start with these physical principles, empirical principles, and then you turn them into general mathematical axioms. So both approaches have advantages.
Do you know what the word separate is doing there? This means various? I don't know.
Individual, I think, is maybe a better translation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that make more sense? Individual processes,
I presume it's in German.
Yeah.
Originally it wasn't.
Yeah.
You don't have the German.
I don't. that's a good question, actually, because this was a letter that was published in the London Times. This was the original source. So I assume that at some point it was translated from German and not originally in English in 1990, but I don't actually know that.
In those days, letters to the editor.
Yeah, in those days, letters to the editor had actual content. Yeah. Okay, so on the one hand, the constructed models have particular advantages. They're give you complete description of the system. You can adapt them to new systems that you want to describe, or they're relatively clear about what you're talking about. Also, they're explanatory, and this is one of the major advantages. On the other side, if you're pursuing this analytic method, because it's deductive, you have, and because your principles you've started out with are principles that you have good empirical evidence for, you have secure foundations in the principles, and it's logical because it's deductive. Okay, but the main reason why Einstein felt that he had to pursue the principle theory approach with special relativity was that he knew, of course, this is 1905, his Annus Mirabilis, he knew already that there were, if he was going to try and pursue the constructive approach, there was already a great deal of uncertainty in how he would try to model the system, how he would try to model systems, right? Because he knew that quantum mechanics was on the horizon and was going to create problems for this constructive approach. Okay, so Einstein himself doesn't talk about what his motivations were for formulating this distinction. As far as he doesn't talk about whether he was influenced by other people's thinking in formulating this distinction. So I'm not an Einstein scholar, but Don Howard has looked carefully into this and says that he couldn't find anywhere where Einstein cites anybody else as a source for this distinction. But by the time, by the early 1900s, that distinction between principle and constructive theories was very much in the air and all over physics. So presumably Einstein was influenced by the presence of the distinction in other cases. So in particular, Maxwell's thinking about electromagnetism, he's very self-conscious about the different methods he uses at different points in his formulation of electromagnetism and development of his field equations. So he talks about principle theories. And then Poincaré picking up on Maxwell and trying to work through the Maxwell's treatise on electromagnetism in some detail, also talks about the physics of principles. So what he has in mind when he talks about the physics of principles is the theories of analytical dynamics, Lagrange, Poisson, Hamilton, Jacobi, and others, Fourier's theory of heat, which was an early input to electromagnetism as well, Hamilton's and Cauchy's optics, as well as Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which is the sort of culmination of all of this. So the example I'm going to talk about is the electromagnetism example, as an example of the principle theory approach to physics, which is, I take it, a successful example of the application of that methodology, but and also recognized as an example of a principle approach to theorizing. But it's not one of the standard examples that gets trotted out when the principle constructive distinctions talked about. The standard examples are special relativity, thermodynamics versus the kinetic theory of gases. So I think that what I want to suggest is that by looking at this additional example, we can see that the methodology might be a little bit looser, there might be some more options for using the methodology than are evident from looking at the other examples. Yes?
I'm a little surprised to see something like Fourier's theory of heat. I suppose that means the diffusion equation or the heat.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to see that called the theory of principle. Wouldn't we would call it active theory or phenomenological theory or something like that, but what's the principles behind it? In the case of thermodynamics, I can see there's
right. A
second law, this principle that you can't build perpetual motion machine.
Right.
What's the principle?
So the principles behind, it's a principle theory according to Poincaré because Fourier doesn't make any specific assumptions about what heat is or what properties
right,
it has.
It's a phenomenological theory.
Well,
it's not the same thing as...
It's not the same thing. Well, so it's based on phenomenological principles then. Right. So the big question when Fourier was developing his theory of heat is whether heat was caloric or what kind of substance
right.
heat was. Right. So he self-consciously avoided making any constructive theory modeling type assumptions about
right.
what kind of thing heat was.
But I can understand that.
Yeah.
So would you draw any distinct? I mean, are you conflating or are you assuming that a phenomenological theory or an effective theory is the same thing as a principled theory, and that's in, to be contrasted with a constructive theory?
That's a good question. So one of the things that's going to come out by looking at this example is, and one of the things I want to ask, is whether this use of the methodology is operationalist or not, right? And it's certainly empirical, right, in that the starting point is a set of principles which constrain quantities which are empirically accessible. So that might be a good question to come back with later. I think another reason why it comes up on this list is because Poincaré was thinking about Maxwell. And so Maxwell was, of course, inspired by William Thomson, right? And William Thomson's initial analogies that he used to formulate his theory of electrostatics were drawn from Fourier's theory of heat. So that could also be another reason for it. All right, so let me talk a little bit about Maxwell then. Okay, so Maxwell infamously started out thinking about electromagnetism and was very much approaching the problem of how to formulate a theory of electromagnetism in a constructive way. So this is a nicer version of one of his famous diagrams. This is a model that he introduced in order to model electromagnetic induction. And so it's the magnetism is represented by all the hexagons, which are vortices. And so you're supposed to think of a fluid in earlier versions or some type of elastic solid in later versions. And they rotate. And so that's representing the rotational nature of electromagnetism. The electric current is modeled by these little, Maxwell calls them idle wheels. So from A here to B, you have these idle wheels. So the motion of the current is represented by the rotation of the idle wheels going from left to right across the diagram. So the interaction between electricity and magnetism is modeled by so if you are thinking about what the motion of the current does, it causes a magnetic field by physically rotating these vortices that are in between the idle wheels. Okay, so that was a model that was very important for Maxwell as a stepping stone to deriving his equations, which clearly posits a whole bunch of specific details about how you represent the model. Models is sort of like the kinetic theory of gases model in that it involves a whole bunch of detailed assumptions about the microscopic details of the system. So Maxwell was, as I said, very self-conscious about the methodology he was using. And so this is what he has to say in the paper in which he published this model. The conception of a particle having its motion connected with that of a vortex by perfect rolling contact may appear somewhat awkward. I do not bring it forward as a mode of connection existing in nature, or even as that which I would willingly assent to as an electrical hypothesis. It is, however, a mode of connection which is mechanically conceivable, and it serves to bring out the actual mechanical connections between known electromagnetic phenomena. So what he's saying here is he doesn't think this particular model that he's introducing is representative of the actual mechanism that exists in nature, which is responsible for electromagnetic phenomena. But he does think that there is some mechanism. Okay, so what he's saying here is he does think that there's a mechanical underpinning to electromagnetic phenomena, that they are caused by particles, by matter in motion. And so he's saying that he does think that there is an ether. But he's also not trusting his model, the particular model he's introducing, as being an accurate representation. So later he says he writes in a letter to Tate, who's the author of a textbook on Lagrangian mechanics in 1867 with William Thomson. The nature of this mechanism is to the true mechanism what an orrery is to the solar system. So that's how he's thinking of his model. It's when you have, it's like one of those mechanical tabletop demonstrations that they had of
The solar system.
Yeah, that you find at a planetarium. Yeah. Okay. And later he reflects when he gets to the to writing his treatise on electromagnetism a few years later. The mechanism required to establish a given species of connection between the motions of the parts of a system always admits of an infinite number of solutions. Of these, some may be more clumsy or more complex than others, but all must satisfy the conditions of mechanism in general. Okay, so the complex and clumsy ones are an example of that would be these idle wheels that he has that he doesn't like in the model that he uses. But what he wants to do, draw from that example, and in fact, there's an infinite number of possible models, right? So there's this sort of epistemic problem that if you want to start with the constructive approach here, there's an infinite number of possible models, and you don't really know what the right one is. But what you can glean from the approach is that any type of mechanism must satisfy certain general abstract conditions. And this is what he's going to seize on, and that's what he's going to, the approach he's going to take in the treatise. So at that point, he moves from this constructive approach to developing electromagnetism to a principal approach to developing electromagnetism. So the analogy he uses is an analogy to a belfry. So this is supposed to be, I've covered up the bells here. But the idea here is that you should imagine that you are a bell ringer and that you have a whole bunch of ropes. So if you're standing underneath the belfry, the bells move by pulling the ropes. But in this case, instead of having bells in your belfry, you have a bunch of mechanisms. So you can control the motion of the mechanisms by pulling on these ropes, and you're assuming that you're entirely responsible for the motion of these mechanisms. They're literally in a black box. They're hidden from you. You can't go up in the ceiling of your belfry and look at what's there. So he says what you should do in this case is you should use Lagrange's equations to predict the motion of the ropes when they're acted on by specific forces, given the initial values of the shifts and the velocities. So what you're doing is you're taking advantage of of what's empirically accessible to you. You can calculate, you can figure out by doing various experiments on your ropes and seeing what happens. You can calculate the kinetic energy and the potential energy as functions of the coordinates and the velocities of the ropes. And then you can then, given that you know what forces you're exerting, you can determine what's going to happen to the ropes when you do that. Okay, so he says exactly the same thing as what we need to do with electromagnetism. We, instead of trying to come up with particular mechanical models of electromagnetism, what we should do instead is treat that as the black box, like whatever mechanism it is up in the belfry. We can derive equations for electromagnetism by sticking to the empirically accessible quantities and then determining experimentally how they're related, apply Lagrange's equations, and then you can do the same trick as you can do with the belfry, and what you come out with at the end, he derives Maxwell's equations using the method. One of the key assumptions that comes in here, which was kind of obvious in the belfry case, maybe less obvious in this case, is that the electromagnetic system that you are working with, so you're conducting circuits, your magnets, and also space in this case, right, because we're going to be assigning energies to fields in the end, possess kinetic energy and potential energy. So that's what you're assuming in order to do the derivation. Okay, so he does this in the special case in which you have closed circuits in the treatise, and then others, after he passes away, complete the work of doing this and working it out for other cases in electromagnetism. So, question then. This is an example of principle a theory approach to theorizing. Why was this approach successful in this particular case? In this case, it was successful because black boxing the details of the mechanism was a good strategy because we know now, and this is the part where we're now looking retrospectively and asking this question. Maxwell didn't know this. He thought there was an ether. He thought that there was a mechanism underpinning the electromagnetism. But we now know that the simple machine examples that he was coming, models that he was coming up with, his earlier hydrodynamical models, are different in kind than the electromagnetism models. So black boxing those types of, those details turned out to be a good strategy, because also it turned out to be the case that the assumption that all of the system, all of the theories shared structural properties turned out to be correct. So the structural properties that were in common were captured by Lagrange's equations. So when you back up to the level of forces and potential and kinetic energies, then you can then the relationships between those properties are common to all of those systems. So one lesson I think we can take from this case is that abstract principles are more likely to survive in new theories than concrete assumptions about systems. Yes?
First of all, I didn't realize this. Did Maxwell derive his equations from a Lagrangian? Did he write down the Lagrangian, what we would now write down? You know, f mu nu squared or something like that, and get, I've never heard that.
He uses.
That's not the story that you're usually told.
He doesn't get all the way there, right? So.
But he got all the way to the equations.
He got all the way to the equations. Yeah.
Somehow he did it without assuming. There's something else that was used, not just that one should write down a Lagrangian. He wouldn't even have known what Lagrangian. He would have had a hard time finding one because he didn't have the idea of covariance or Lorentz invariance to guide him.
So what he was doing was he was using Lagrange's equations.
He was using Lagrange's.
Yeah.
So he arrived at or he presented Maxwell's equations in the form of the Euler-Lagrange equations for some action. I mean, I've never heard that. The story is told is usually different. That he was guided by conservation of charge. And so, he just wrote down different partial differential equations to incorporate what people knew at the time, and he noticed that it violated conservation of charge, but if you added one particular term, then you could restore conservation of charge, and that was Maxwell's equations. Is that story wrong?
Well, so what I want to because he didn't get all the way to writing down a Lagrangian, right? In the way that we would think of it in modern,
old language, did he write it down? That's what I'm wondering.
Sorry, what do you mean in old language?
Well, I mean, separating electric and magnetic fields and using coordinates and. Assuming a particular frame of reference and so on. But I mean, the way that I suppose Maxwell's equations originally were written down in that way. I mean, never mind, that may be a red herring. I'm just saying, did he in any form write down a Lagrangian for the equations? And so was it first or second?
He was still looking at special cases, right, at this point. Right, so he was looking at closed circuits as a special case.
There weren't waves yet.
Well, yeah, and so there's a lot more work that had to be done, and this is why. So who finishes the work? Fitzgerald finishes the work. Lorentz finishes the work, right later on. It's also, as far as I'm aware, the first textbook that introduces. Lagrange's methods for, in a way that they could be applied by contemporary physicists, was Thompson and Tate's textbook, which was in 1867. The treatise came out in 1873, right? So it's a stepping stone to how we would present electromagnetism in a modern way, right?
Okay.
But it's still a work in progress.
And so the reason I'm asking this is I kind of resist this idea that it's an example of a principle theory. I think you didn't refer at all to Faraday in what you said, but from what I've read, Faraday was the one who struck this new form of matter, what we now call the electromagnetic field. It may not be just a bunch of the real contrast is not...
It's between mechanical explanation and a field and this new concept.
Right, there's a material difference between
Right.
Mechanical theories versus more general forms of theories,
which
can admit new forms of matter that are not mechanical, and that's...
Right.
That seems to me that that's the more fundamental...
That's the more fundamental...
step that was taken here. So once you admit that there is such a thing as an electromagnetic field, then you can say, I look for a theory, a principle theory, or a phenomenological theory, or whatever you want to call it, to describe the behavior of this field. But you have to come to the idea that the field is something. Whereas if you were a real operationalist, you would have said, no, there's no field. There's just these charge, you know, these currents and these conductors and these batteries and stuff like this. In fact, when I taught, once I taught undergraduate E&M, you know, and the very old textbooks, textbooks are usually a century behind the times, I guess, and they would say the electromagnetic field is nothing but, you know, something that that describes the motion of charged particles, something like this, which I guess may have been a very traditional, old-fashioned way of thinking about the electromagnetic field. So that So going to the electromagnetic field is explicitly going beyond an operational approach.
Right. Okay, so two things. So one of the things I want to push here is I think this is an example of the approach of a principle theory approach to theorizing, but I'm not convinced that it's an operationalist approach. Okay,
well, it's a principle approach. Once you recognize the electromagnetic field as a thing in itself or as an empirical thing, otherwise it's not. Because what do the principles refer to? They don't just refer to conductors and, inductors and compasses and blah, blah, blah.
Okay, so let me show you this diagram and see if this helps. Okay, so now I'm thinking retrospectively about this example, right? So now I'm going beyond what Maxwell knew and what Maxwell thought. Although it is the case that he did use Lagrange's equations as an ingredient in his derivation of his electromagnetic equations for particular sets of examples. It's also the case, of course, that he was drawing on Faraday's work, right? And what Faraday contributed was an incredibly valuable store of experimental results about all sorts of different electromagnetic systems, and also the physical idea of that fields were doing something, right? That the fields were physical. So one of the things that's sometimes said about Max, one of the ways in which Maxwell's contributions are sometimes described is as mathematizing Faraday's work, right? Because Faraday was a experimental physicist who did not set his results out in a sort of comprehensive mathematical framework. So that's something else that's often said. That's often said about Maxwell. Okay, so let me clarify then why I'm thinking of this as an example of a principle approach to theorizing. And I'm going to do that by going back to talking about the modal methodology that I started with. So this is, again, retrospective. This is not the way in which Maxwell was thinking about what he was doing. But we now realize that if you think about a landscape of mathematical possibilities, mathematical framework, with landscape of possible theories, then you have a bunch of theories in which forces are related in different ways to energy, to potential and kinetic energy, and the principles of Lagrangian mechanics pick out a specific relationship between the forces and the potential and the kinetic energies. So the principles of Lagrangian mechanics are what is in common which is what is held in common between systems which are simple machines or even complicated machines, hydrodynamics, and then electromagnetism. So Maxwell, of course, didn't realize that electromagnetism was the star over here, right? Maxwell didn't realize that electromagnetism was a classical field theory. He thought that it was going to turn out to be an ether theory, which would be a mechanical theory like the other two, right? So this is what you're pointing out, and that's certainly correct. So why did it turn out to be valuable to stand back and think about the principles of Lagrangian mechanics instead of trying to construct particular mechanical models? Well, I think that was partly why, right? Because the mechanical model, he was successful using the mechanical models, and that was his stepping stone to his equations. Why was he successful in taking that approach? Because he latched on to principles of Lagrangian mechanics, which also apply to classical field theories. Right. So retrospectively, if we want to answer this question about why he was right, it's because he took a step back, thought abstractly about these systems, and also he thought in terms of what he had empirical access to, and that was there was this empirical input to what types of principle he was looking at, and then that was a stepping stone to electromagnetism. Okay, so I'm going to say, get back to quantum theory after this long detour through electromagnetism. And so my question is, what would an analogous methodology look like for quantum theory to this methodology of applying abstract Lagrangian mechanics? I like this way of thinking about it. So here I have my landscape of GPTs, and quantum theory is picked out by whatever principles, and maybe you get a little bit more than quantum theory, depending on whether you think that all these interpretations that you could put in this circle over here are all exactly empirically equivalent or not. It would be nice if it were the case that what you get from reconstructing quantum theory is we have all of these interpretations of quantum theory, but what we're lacking is whatever this correct interpretation of quantum theory is. These other, the Everett interpretation, the Bohm interpretation, GRW, are a little bit like assuming that there's an ether and thinking about hydrodynamics and simple machines as for electromagnetism. So the thought is that by stepping back and by formulating more general principles for quantum theory, which encompass all of these particular interpretations we have right now, you might be able to pick out the correct interpretation of quantum theory. So that would be nice. I think that there's some problems with drawing the analogy in this way. Of course, there's a whole other story I'm not telling about what reasons there were for rejecting ether, right? So there was an experimental, experimental input, there was theoretical input that led to the rejection of ether. One of the telltale signs, even to Maxwell, that you might not have an ether was that the collection of mechanical models and hydrodynamic models of various types that they had for different types of electromagnetic phenomena were all sort of partial and imperfect, right? And they couldn't make any one fit for all of the types of phenomena. So that, I think that would be a disanalogy here, where the proponents of each of these interpretations of quantum theory would argue that these are complete stories about quantum theory, whereas you have sort of partial mechanical models for different types of systems in the electromagnetism case. Here's another way you could think about it. So here I have the landscape and quantum theory. So you might think that the analogy is that you have all sorts of different types of systems, like you have superconductors, you have the hydrogen atom, you have all sorts of different systems to which quantum theory applies. And so, so in the same way that Maxwell, in thinking about abstract principles of Lagrangian mechanics, was led to focus on what was in common to a whole bunch of systems, maybe similarly here, by thinking about all the different types of systems to which quantum theory applies, a principle theory approach to quantum theory can help you think about that. So that, I think, might be the closer physical analogy, but I kind of like this one too. So those are the directions in which I think the analogy works. One other thing I wanted to talk about was is what kinds of principles were used by Maxwell, and what features do they have? What features then might you look for in principles that you use to reconstruct quantum theory? So one thing I've stressed over and over again is they're abstract. They capture general features which are common to a whole set of concrete theories. Einstein actually mentions this. There's the sorts of principles that describe general characteristics of natural processes. So here we come back to the quantum gravity question, right? So in this case, you have unification happening, right? Because the way I draw the picture and the way what happens with this example is that you have electromagnetism and optics are brought under the umbrella of classical mechanics. So the principles of Lagrangian mechanics are generalizations of Newton's original mechanics, and then you recognize that they have that they're satisfied in mechanical systems as well as non-mechanical field classical field systems. However, in this case, when you have a unification, it doesn't usually come for free, right? So the question is, are the seeds of the unification put in to the formalism earlier on, right? And certainly in the case of Hamilton's equations, Hamilton was thinking about optics, right? So Hamilton was thinking about light in that case anyway. So I think this might look good if you want to get towards quantum gravity, but this question that came up earlier about new concepts being needed and how those new concepts get seeded in to unify quantum theory and gravity, they're going to have to come from somewhere. And I think in this case, they were put in at the beginning, right? It's not like you get something for free at the end and you realize that electromagnetic systems are examples of Lagrangian mechanics. It's that the thinking that went into it at the beginning was thinking about a whole bunch of different types of systems. Okay, and another feature is the principles that Maxwell latches onto relate empirically accessible properties, and then the empirically inaccessible ones, the microscopic features, are black boxed, types of properties you would have to posit in order to follow the constructive approach to theorizing. So this is where the question comes in, I think, whether this approach is operationalist. I think this is maybe why Raphael was objecting earlier to whether the example was really an example of a principle approach. So I think that the principles that Maxwell's relying on are empirical in the sense in respect to the fact that they do rely on relating empirically accessible quantities, but they're not operationalist in the more specific sense that they're about measurement operations, right? Or they're about quantities which are defined with respect to how you can measure them, right? So in contrast, if you think about the principles of special relativity and about how the question about what time is and about what length is answered by thinking about rods and clocks and how they move, right? So I don't think that you have something similar happening here. So I think there's two ways to go here. One thing you might say is, okay, well, if this isn't an operationalist way of thinking about systems, then maybe it's not a really good analog, and maybe it's not really that helpful for thinking about how we should reconstruct quantum theory. Because I haven't said anything about quantum information theory, right? I haven't said anything about how information theory informs reconstructions. And if information theory comes in through thinking about things in a more operational kind of way, then you might just think that this example is historically interesting, but maybe not the kind of example we want to have in mind when we are trying to reconstruct quantum theory. So I think this could go either way. I'd be interested to hear what people think. One final thing I want to talk about. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
This phrase, empirically accessible or empirically inaccessible. I mean, when you say empirically inaccessible properties of black box, do you mean sort of empirically inaccessible for now?
Yes. To Maxwell is what I had in mind.
Because if you're going to I mean, this is embroiled in this question about whether these models are conceived of as being phenomenological, or that they're really, some more fundamental description of what's going on. So you might say that, well, they're empirically inaccessible to us now, but if they turn out to be good models and work, and then we're going to say, well, actually, we can now interact, now we have a theory of them, we can actually interact with them, prod them and poke them, and they now become empirically accessible to us. You see what I mean?
What's empirically accessible and what's empirically inaccessible is certainly time dependent, right? And so what's empirically accessible to Maxwell, obviously, we can go far beyond that now, in part because Maxwell did part of the job for us that we needed to have done in coming up with the first theory of electricity and magnetism, and then we've come up with other ones, right? So then that's improved our capacity for doing experiments and for probing and increase what's empirically accessible to us. So Einstein's idea about principle and constructive theories and how they relate is that in some cases you may have to start out with a principle theory because that's where you're at in whatever phase of scientific development, but then hopefully you can follow that up with a constructive theory that underpins that principle theory. Right, so in this case, you might want to say, sure, this is what you needed to do pragmatically in order to come up with electromagnetism. But then, we discovered that you're not going to have a mechanical model. It's not like these idle wheels and vortices. That's not the right picture. But you're still going to want to come up with and construct a model after the fact, right? And that could be informed by being able to have more extensive empirical access to systems. Yeah.
The funny thing is, what you just laid out probably applies perfectly to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. It's not so clear how it applies to the case you're looking at, the electromagnetism, because if you call it a principle theory, it wasn't followed by any constructive theory. It was just followed, the constructive part was just the recognition, look, the electromagnetic field is just something in itself. That is the deeper, but it's not deeper if you regarded that we already had an empirical access to it before, then it's not the deeper reality. It's not the atoms underlying the heat flow.
Right. If,
it's just a change of...
Right. If electromagnetic fields are just whatever the equations refer to.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Then
constructive theory, but you're finding it as a fundamental theory already, or a potential, which I think was Faraday's point of view all along. I read stuff by him where he said, "Look, there's no ether. There's just this electromagnetic field." I don't know quite what he thought it. Either he didn't say, or I don't remember whether it could be ultimately mechanized or not, or something like that. But he seemed to think that it was just some new element of reality, which may or may not have a deeper explanation. And that's what the theory should be about, which is exactly our view now. So it doesn't fit into this nice two-stage.
Right. So then
development.
And so some people pursuing the reconstruction project have said, well, yeah, maybe the principle theory is the end of the road there too, right? So, So one point of view is once you have a principle theory, the next thing you should want to do is construct a constructive theory. Another point of view is maybe you'll discover you're done, right?
In that case, they knew what the principle theory was referring to, which was the electromagnetic field.
Yeah.
The development was to realize, oh, that's good enough. We don't need... But in the case of quantum mechanics, we don't know. That's what you said in the beginning.
Right.
We don't know what it's referring to, so it's never going to be enough.
Right. And of course, this is not a in this case, we know that classical electromagnetism is not the end of the story, right?
Right. But,
and we know that because we have quantum theories, right?
The dynamics changed.
Yeah. Okay, one more thing I want to say before I finish. So I think one of the things that's valuable about thinking about different examples of what counts as a principle theory and how the principle theory approach got played out in the history of physics is, I think, some of the criticisms which the Reconstruction Program comes in for are a result of thinking kind of narrowly about special relativity. So here's, I'm going to pick on Chris Fuchs here. So I think here's what I have in mind. In the Information Theoretic Foundations and Foils, a nice volume by Julio and Rob, edited by Julio and Rob, Chris offers a few criticisms of operationalist reconstructions of quantum theory. One is that the principles from which quantum theory has been reconstructed are not the right ones because they lack the shock value when you juxtapose them. So in special relativity, when you put together the relativity principle with the light postulate, initially it seems like these two things shouldn't be consistent with one another, and then you have to do work in order to figure out how they're consistent. One response to this could be, well, that was the case in special relativity, but maybe that was a special feature of special relativity. I don't think it's the case in the example that I just went through in the use of Lagrangian mechanics in electromagnetism. And the second sort of thought is that, following Wheeler, we'll know when we've done it right when we can state the principle in one clear, simple sentence. That's the answer to how you construct quantum theory. So again, I think if we think about how this plays out in the Lagrangian mechanics case, I don't think the principles of Lagrangian mechanics satisfy that requirement of allowing you to have one clear, simple sentence. It's not that kind of thing. So again, maybe that's somewhat of a help. And I do think, actually, this is another topic, but I do think that Lucien's continuity axiom, the continuous reversibility axiom, that in quantum theory you can take a pure state and continuously and reversibly transform it into any other pure state. I think that there's, some sort of similarity in degree of abstraction and how you manipulate quantities with thinking about how Lagrangian mechanics work. So I think those two types of axioms might have something in common. All right. I'd said I was going to say something about quantum field theory, but it's now past time than I said I would stop. So maybe I will save that for another day.
Principles of Lagrangian mechanics are physical principles, and is it necessary that do these principles of Lagrangian mechanics require that the Lagrangian is the difference of the kinetic and potential energies, or are the principles of Lagrangian mechanics just some kind of action principle that there is a Lagrangian of some sort? It may not be related to kinetic and potential energies, but there is some action and it is extremized, and that gives you the equations of motion. And would you then, if that's the case, would you then sort of say that quantum theory can be expressed as a sum over histories would be a physical principle?
That's a good question. So what I do want to do is make room for abstract physical principles. So I'm not sure. I was thinking of this more in terms of an analogy rather than applying this particular methodology to quantum theory itself. What would you say? Would you?
Oh. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't feel much like, what's physical depends on you having a particular framework already in mind, a theory already in mind, maybe a provisional one or you know, physics as we kind of currently partially know, you know, at our current stage of knowledge, we have these concepts and then physical must refer to those concepts, or physical refers to some partially sketched out new theory with new concepts within it, and then physical would refer to those. I don't think in this way, so I'm kind of struggling to to say whether I consider principles of Lagrangian mechanics to be physical principles. Yeah.
Right. So maybe, okay, let's go back to this picture. Does this picture make sense? Okay, that's, yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. So the big box is not Lagrangian theories. I don't understand this. So the big box is what? What is that?
Different relationships that.
Possible.
So this is supposed to be the analog of the GPT framework.
Right. So
the way I'm thinking about it.
What is it in this?
So the Lagrangian principles are principles that pick out a point within this space.
Right. But what are the bigger points? That's what I.
So the bigger points are other ways in which forces are related to.
But are they theories in which forces? I mean, is it all mechanical theories or is it all? So I don't see.
It's
in the GPT case, you know what that bigger space is. In this case, now I realize I don't know what that bigger space is.
Okay, so in the GPT case, you know what the other points are because you can have classical probabilistic theories as being a point in the space, and so you do know what some of the points in the space are.
Abstractly defined what that arena is?
Right.
In this case, I'm not.
I haven't abstractly defined it.
Yes.
Okay. So. The question of whether they'd be mechanical theories or what. I mean, I don't know. I guess they'd be like, this is a mathematical,
it's just all the theory
mathematical framework,
we're
right?
Thinking about it.
And, yeah.
How would you say it? A conditional question. I mean, were you going to say something about quantum gravity? If so, what was it?
Oh, so I talked about unification, right?
I have 5 minutes,
okay.
Plenty of time for quantum.
So what you might think, okay, this is great because we have this unification happening in the electromagnetism case, right? So what you have is you have the unification is that you have these general principles of Lagrangian mechanics, and you bring electromagnetism and optics under that same set of principles. You already have mechanical systems. You already have hydrodynamics. So you have this big space of theories.
When you say classical mechanics, or you mean Lagrangian?
I mean Lagrangian mechanics, thought of as being some sort of generalization of Newtonian mechanics, right?
You don't mean point particles?
No, I don't. Sorry. Yeah, I wanted. So, of course, initially the idea was that you have Newtonian mechanics, by which I mean Newton's Principia, right? And so the question is how. If at all, you're going to be able to bring electromagnetism and optics within the scope of the project in Newton's Principia. And then this, of course, it turns out to be crucial that you also have to broaden the scope of what you mean by classical mechanics to analytical mechanics as well. So there is a unification happening here, but as I said, the analog would be unifying quantum theory and gravity. In this case, though, I think you have the seeds of the unification coming into the development of Lagrangian mechanics earlier, right? So it's not like you get the unification for free, as I was saying. It's not like you discover that, lo and behold, once you figure out Lagrangian mechanics, then you also get electromagnetism and optics coming in under the umbrella. You need to have some concepts and physical content coming in there at the beginning. So I don't think it would be great if by just pursuing the reconstruction of quantum theory and only thinking about quantum theory, then somehow we'd be able to get gravity in there. But I expect that you're also going to need some new concepts, as you were saying, some seeds in order to seed the unification. It's not going to come for free.
We enter in a very abstract way because by the time you get to Lagrangian mechanics, it really has no optical feel about it. I mean, by the time it's applied to electromagnetism, it looks very different.
Right.
You're suggesting some analogous thing.
Well, and so actually this is a part of the history I need to think more about and go back further into the history. But what I was thinking of here was actually more Hamiltonian mechanics.
When did
right?
Hamilton do this?
So Hamilton was the early part of the 1800s, the early mid 1800s. But he was explicitly thinking about optics. And different emission theories of light and wave theories of light and similarities between them. And so, thank you.